Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. Well, we're going to get a sneak peek backstage in the Global Theater in just a few moments. Kind of reminds me of that scene in The Wizard of Oz when Dorothy's dog Toto tears back the curtain and we see, instead of the all-powerful Oz, we see this little old man with his hands on the levers of power. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. Theodore Roosevelt Malick is next on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Theodore Roosevelt Malick is the chairman and CEO of the Roosevelt Group, a leading strategic advisory and thought leadership company. He was a research professor at Yale University and a fellow at Wolfson College, Oxford University. Malick has served on the executive board of the World Economic Forum, that's Davos. He had an ambassadorial level post in the United Nations, has worked in international capital markets on Wall Street, and has served in senior policy positions at the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations and in the U.S. State Department. He has served on numerous foundations and corporate mutual fund and not-for-profit educational boards, and currently advises numerous international and U.S. governmental advisory bodies and think tanks. His latest book is Davos, Aspen, and Yale, My Life Behind the Elite Curtain as a Global Sherpa. Theodore Roosevelt Malick, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Very pleased to be with you. I'm talking from outside of London, England today, so I'm 8 hours or more ahead.
Well, we appreciate you getting up bright and early to be with us. I have to ask you about your name, Theodore Roosevelt Malick. Are you a descendant of the 26th President of the United States?
Well, in fact, a distant relative. My grandmother is a Roosevelt on my father's side, so my father had the same name as Senior. I'm a junior, and I was always slightly embarrassed as a kid by that name. Had to duck under the desk, but it's quite a good mnemonic device. People actually remember who you are. And interestingly now, with Roosevelt's full face on Mount Rushmore, at least in the United States, I would say more or less everyone appreciates that great president.
And he was known to do battle with the multinationals from time to time. So perhaps, as they say, the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. Would you sort of cast yourself in that same, not that you're Theodore Roosevelt, but that you also sort of see yourself in that light, sort of standing up for the nation state and battling the forces of globalism?
Well, that would be a very honorable banner to fly under. He was an unexpected American president because, of course, his presidency resulted from McKinley's assassination. But he also accomplished a great deal in his time and was a very pugnacious fighter for America and America abroad. He was also the first American ever to win the Nobel Prize for solving the dispute between Russia and Japan. So, I have just about every biography written about Theodore Roosevelt. I really recommend them to your readers and your listeners. They are fantastic and uplifting.
You were referred to as a global Sherpa. I believe that was Lady Thatcher, former Prime Minister of Great Britain, who gave you that moniker. What does that mean? What is a global Sherpa?
Well, yeah, I can tell you the whole story. Of course, what it means is a Sherpa is when you go to the Himalayas or Himalaya Mountains and you have to get your bags to the top, and it's a rather vertical climb. You hire a bunch of locals who are rather adept at that, and very skilled mountaineers and trainers, adventurers, and they get both you and your bags to the top of the mountain peak. So it is a euphemism for a person who is capable of doing that. It was 1992, and I was organizing a conference, actually for CNN and with CNN, called the World Economic Development Congress. We held it in Washington, D.C., just before the World Bank IMF meetings, and we had about 2,500 world leaders there, heads of state, ministers of finance and economics, and I think about 300 CEOs from around the world. And the keynote speaker at that meeting, well, there were two. One was Henry Kissinger. The foremost was Lady Margaret Thatcher. Before she spoke, she went on to say that whoever invented this Congress, and of course I had introduced her, so she knew right well who that was, and thanked me, calling me a global Sherpa. So since then, it has been a kind of moniker that I've been able to use. Very honorable. There are very few people, I think, in at least recent world history like Margaret Thatcher.
My favorite Margaret Thatcher line is, the problem with socialism is eventually you run out of other people's money.
That's a lot of good one-liners. She was a great singer. She gave this speech, it was in September of 1992. You might recall it was televised live on CNN. She basically said that Britain is not going to be involved any longer in the European Monetary Union and regulatory affairs, that it should consider or reconsider its place in Europe. It's the very day when George Soros, who was also at that conference, went to the urinal with me and then went on to short the pound and made $1.5 billion. But it was a very, very important speech. I had breakfast with her and Lou Dobbs and a couple other people before she spoke, and she had obviously stayed up late into the night writing and changing her own speech because she had it in front of her and it had all kinds of red marks all over it. And I asked her, don't you have a speechwriter? She said, I am my own speechwriter.
Not surprised. You mentioned the European Union. You were at one time considered maybe, I guess, the odds-on favorite to be the ambassador to the EU, Trump's ambassador to the EU, and that didn't happen. And you had been pretty outspoken. I forgive me if I'm misquoting you, but I think you compared the European Union to the former Soviet Union. So you didn't have a lot of fans in Europe. Is that why you were not named ambassador?
Well, one never knows. I was involved as a surrogate and an advisor during the entire Trump campaign, and I did go to Trump Tower actually two occasions and to the final panel. There's no question that I would have been named ambassador to the European Union. I was in line to do that. People like Rudy Giuliani even whispered that in my ear. When my name was floated, the Europeans, and not universally, it means there are certain Europeans who are very keen both on me and on people like me and certainly on Donald Trump, who have more interest in the future of a sovereign nation state. But those on the left, in particular, in the European Parliament, the European Union, were not all that excited about Trump being president, and they were even less excited about my representing him in Brussels. I did go on BBC, literally hundreds of times, I think, in the press in Britain, and one of the things I did say that the EU-SSR, in fact, is a lot like the Soviet Union, and in a previous career when I had been a diplomat in Geneva, Switzerland, at the end of the Cold War, we helped bring down the Soviet Union. And there's another union that needs a little taming. So they didn't like that kind of talk. And in fact, they wrote a letter, which I actually have on my desk. It's something I've now framed, saying that if I were appointed, I would be made persona non grata, which is a diplomatic status for not welcome.
And you see that as a badge of honor, I'm guessing?
I see it as a great badge of honor. I'm chuckling even as I think of it. I would also remind, not the Americans care that much, but I would remind the Europeans that Donald Trump has not yet appointed an ambassador to the European Union.
What is the future of the EU in your estimation? Is it destined to unwind? Will it rebound?
Yeah. Well, it's anyone's guess. The head of the European Union, Jean-Claude Juncker, coming from Luxembourg, last year commissioned a group internally to think about that very question, and they came up with five different scenarios. I actually think there are about 35 different scenarios, which also suggests that they don't know where they're going. There is an ambition on the part of some, himself included, in Europe, and the stronger powers, probably Macron and Merkel in Germany, to make it an ever closer political union. In other words, to become the United States of Europe. But there are all kinds of other forces at work that don't want that to happen, who see it as an economic union, who would like to see it less integrative, and that, frankly, don't want that kind of bureaucratic, bloated organization running European affairs. So Americans have their own point of view on that question, but I think it's quite fascinating when you have countries like Britain now, of course, the third largest country, very powerful one in Europe, deciding to leave the European Union. And I also said on television that they should put referenda before every European country and let the people decide democratically whether they want to be in or out of that union, or whether they want to be in or out of that euro currency. Not all the countries that are part of the European Union even use their common currency. So there are a lot of questions, a lot of moving parts. And the elections last year obviously had some effect on that. And there are elections coming up, frankly, in the next few months that will also be speaking volumes that we should be watching, most particularly the election the first week of March in Italy.
Right. We have populist movements in Italy and elsewhere. But back to England for a moment. Will they actually leave? It seems to me that the Conservative government there is kind of soft peddling that, almost as if they want to revisit the whole referendum. Are they in fact going to leave? Will there be a Brexit?
Yes, there is a Brexit. It's decided and determined. You can't replay history. You don't get it to, you know, to vote a second time. The decision was made decisively in June of 2016. And yes, the government, which is one of some difficulty, Prime Minister May is trying to sort out that issue, both under Article 50, when they leave, which is now determined, and how they'll leave, and then what the transition period will be like. They call it the implementation phase, and then when, in fact, you know, in 2019, the United Kingdom leaves Europe altogether and tries to come up with. This is the very difficult negotiation they're in throes of now, and it's actually been quite nasty. It's the one topic that is pervasively covering the English newspapers and news every day, and that is, what will post-Brexit Britain look like? You know, how will it relate to Europe, which is an important question, but more importantly, perhaps, and in fact, one of the reasons for Brexit in itself, was what would a global Britain look like? How will it relate to the rest of the world? Will it have these very interesting bilateral trade agreements with countries from the United States to India to China, to Turkey, et cetera, and how will they get from point A to point B? It's a choppy terrain, and the government is a bit shaky, and there are, I would say, at least two factions within the present Conservative Party, what some people refer to as the Remainers. That means those who wanted to remain a part of Europe but didn't want the Brexit to occur, and the Brexiteers, the Leavers, who wanted to leave. So in some ways, that debate is still going on within the British cabinet, and we can talk about personalities. I know all of them. And the Remainers are now known as Remoaners. In other words, they lost the vote, but they're moaning about the outcome.
And what of countries like Poland, Hungary, Austria? That they seem to be thumbing their nose at the European Union. Are they likely to make an exit?
So another statement I made on TV, and I'll make it here, is that if you put the letters of any European country in front of the word exit, you have a movement in that country. So Brexit, obviously, is the British version of that leaving. You know, in almost every country, in France, you had the, you know, Le Pen candidacy, which did remarkably well. In Italy, you have the center-right forces who certainly want to leave the Euro, if not the European Union. In Poland and Hungary and potentially other Eastern European countries, Central European countries, you have great dissatisfaction, particularly around immigration questions with Brussels, where they don't want to be dictated to. So if you put this whole constellation together, you mentioned the word populism, you could say resurgent nationalism, you certainly have a refocus on the sovereignty of nations. Where you have that, and I would say it's a pretty pervasive effect in Europe presently, also pretty much effect, in effect in the United States with the presidency of Donald Trump, you have a you know, you have a kind of movement which is anti-globalism, more interested in the sovereign status of nations, critical of certainly unfettered immigration. And that is the tide that's coming in right now. I mean, I don't want to call it good or bad. It's just a political fact.
But how would you gauge the health of the nation state? I mean, I see this sort of this titanic struggle taking place between the forces of globalism and those who still believe in the sanctity, if you will, of the nation state. I mean, are we seeing the last gasp of the nation state? We have a prime minister here in Canada that refers to this country as the world's first post-nation state. He seems to be kind of a one-worlder. I mean, how do you gauge the health of the nation state? Is it coming back?
Canadians would feel about that. Myself, having studied in Canada, did a PhD at the University of Toronto. I doubt that most Canadians. Well, Canada is certainly a middle power, integrated as much north and south as it is east to west, seemingly. But I mean, I think Canadian nationalism and Canadian identity is still, you know, fairly strong, still very evident. I've been watching the Olympics last night. They were wearing the maple leaf. I would say we're at a certain point, maybe a decade ago, it looked like the integrated global economy, and that the movement towards multilateralism, and in the case of the European Union, the denigration of the nation state into a kind of more unified state system that had eradicated sovereignty. You could say it was edging along. I'm not saying that we had one world government. That was an emphasis, certainly at the foundation of the United Nations, which has been a disappointing, effect. But I would say for decades that seemed to be edging along. But in the last 3, 4, 5 years, the sentiment is the tide has gone out. So globalism is under very sharp attack. I've been quoted as saying Davos man is dead. The nation state is resurgent. Lots of the activity in Europe, and certainly with America First, is in those sovereign places. So I don't believe the nation state is going away. And we have to find a way to put together a state-centric system that deals with sovereignty again. That doesn't mean there won't be any discussion about global issues or that multilateral organizations will cease to exist. But I think there's a great deal of criticism and not nearly the optimism that there was about them some short decade ago.
We're coming up on a break. When we come back, I want to talk about Davos, Switzerland. They host the World Economic Forum, and President Trump attended recently, I guess, both to boast to and confront this crowd that I think disdains him. It's also curious that some of the people that show up there, people like Bono from U2, I'd like to get your insights into what Davos is all about, this World Economic Forum. And we'll also talk about the Aspen Institute, the United Nations, and much more. Theodore Roosevelt Malik is with us, the author of Davos, Aspen, and Yale, My Life Behind the Elite Curtain as a Global Sherpa. NASA has found the biggest black holes. They found that the biggest black holes are expanding far quicker than previously thought. The rate that these supermassive black holes, or huge celestial bodies at their center of large galaxies, are growing at a rate that outstrips the pace at which their galaxies can form new stars. This means that many of the universe's biggest black holes are far larger than first thought, and they could be gradually wiping out their own host galaxies, experts say. The discovery could reshape our understanding of how galaxies and their black holes form and coexist. They seem to have a voracious appetite. Maybe the key to saving the universe and humankind is to introduce these black holes to Jenny Craig. Imagine a black hole in one of their TV commercials. I dropped 400 billion pounds on Jenny Craig. It's real simple, black hole. You eat the food, you lose the weight. I don't know, just a thought. When we come back, Theodore Roosevelt Malik will take us inside Davos, the World Economic Forum. Why did Trump go? This is the world's largest party for globalist elites. It seems like the antithesis of Trump's America First worldview. Well, we'll find out when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Theodore Roosevelt Malik is with us, the author of Davos, Aspen, and Yale, My Life Behind the Elite Curtain as a Global Sherpa. So take us inside Davos, this World Economic Forum. It was held a few weeks ago in Switzerland. It sounds a little bit like the Bilderberg Group. Tell us about it, Theodore.
Well, it certainly has similar origins. Davos, the World Economic Forum, takes place every year annually at the end of January in a small Swiss mountain village by the name of Davos in the canton of Graubünden in eastern Switzerland. It's the place where Thomas Mann wrote The Magic Mountain. It's originally a sanatorium, a place where people go to regain their health, to overcome the travails of normal life. And in some ways, the World Economic Forum, which is a more recent creation, is similar. It's a place where a mad German professor brought together originally some European managers to talk about the future of Europe and of corporate life and of capitalism itself, and it has evolved into this rather robust cabal of globalists who think they're in charge of the world and with the help of so-called neutral Switzerland bring people together from the not-for-profit side, governmental side, and the corporate side to talk about the risks of the present world. Very few of their discussions are about the rewards today or the creation of wealth, but all the downsides, frankly, of the world we presently live in. So it's not a place that you would have thought that newly elected President Donald Trump would show up, because it is the paragon of globalism. And is it a place that, frankly, is subtly anti-American and critical of American power? It's a much more Eurocentric position on the world, and frankly, fairly anti-capitalist in some ways. It's also become a place for great celebrities, as you mentioned, to quote, hang out and kind of feel good. Angelina Jolie in a hot tub, Bono, this year Elton John, people of that ilk. So I think Trump took the bull by the horns and basically said, I'm going to go there and give them my America First message and invite them all to, in fact, come to America to invest in what we're doing and to bring their money back and the jobs back to America. And what he created was more than a sandstorm, a kind of a euphoria, really, about Trumponomics. It was really Trumpomania this year at Davos. So I was jokingly saying to one broadcaster that it was very much more like the U.S. Economic Forum than the World Economic Forum in this iteration.
And how was he received then? I mean, he went there ostensibly, what, to thumb his nose, to confront them, to boast? How was he received?
He didn't give them the middle finger, so he read off the script. The only unscripted part, I guess, was a few comments going down the steps when he said some words that were not scripted. And then there was a surprising two-minute question and answer session where the head of Davos, Herr Klaus Schwab, asked him two pretty inane questions that he didn't seem prepared for, so he gave his more cryptic kind of tweet-like Donald Trump answers. But other than that, I think he did a spectacular job talking about how America is coming back. Was that well-received at Davos? Somebody said there's about $7 or $8 trillion that have been created in wealth since Trump became president. The stock market certainly has been volatile in the last couple of weeks, but many of the people in the room had benefited from that wealth effect. So while they might have different political opinions and favor slightly different policies, they were all living with a much expanded wallet.
And when I made the comparison with the Bilderberg Group, I mean, what is the idea for this gathering? Are they looking to make deals with little public input? Is that the idea? They sort of away from the media? Is that what they're trying to do?
Well,
Are
the
they trying to
media
pull a
has
fast
become
one?
very much a part of Davos. They've welcomed the media in, so it's a feeding frenzy for media. I would say originally they had the idea that they could have behind the scenes, you mentioned in your opening, a kind of Wizard of Oz kind of experience behind the scenes, talking about the coordination, if you will, of world economies. That doesn't frankly happen, but it is a meeting place, so to that degree it's useful. You can see lots of people from lots of different countries all in one place and make deals and talk about this or that, some of it with a policy orientation. It's probably less conspiratorial than the Bilderberg group, which is a closed group. Davos, frankly, if you pay, you can play. So if you have $71,000, which I think was the cost to attend this year, you could conceivably go. And if your company, and most of the big ones, a lot of medium-sized ones too, will pay $1 million, you can become a member. Bilderberg is not organized on that principle. It's slightly different.
Would the equivalent in the United States be something like the Trilateral Commission?
Well, that's another good example. Some people have compared it to the Bohemian Grove. These are, you know, they're all variations on a theme. They're not all the same, although they have similar ideologies. There are places where the elite like to go to hear themselves talk and to create relationships. And, you know, to some extent, Davos has been quite successful at doing that. I think it may have run its course.
And what about the sort of the legendary debauchery that we hear that takes place at places like Bohemian Grove? Is that myth, or does that sort of ethos exist with these elites that have, you know, more money than God?
Well, I mean, you're sworn to secrecy in some of these circles, but yes, there's a high degree of what could you say it? Vice. So, I mean, at one point in my, and certainly in this memoir book I wrote, I said I had the guest list of not only who was there, which is somewhat guarded, but who their actual guests were, and most of them were not their spouses. So there's a very big party-like atmosphere. In the case of the Bohemian Grove, it's more oriented towards a degree of idol worship. There is no idol worship at Davos, but a lot of celebrities, you know, quote-unquote, having a good time. The partying goes on well into the wee hours of the morning, so that people wake up with rather bleary-eyed eyes in the snowstorms to attend the first sessions.
Is this an opportunity for certain world leaders or key figures to be blackmailed?
Well, it would be an interesting hypothesis. The Russians are there. They're usually the best at the kompromat, which always happened in the Soviet Union. And we'll come back to that subject because it's the subject of my new book, The Plot to Destroy Trump, The Hunt for Red November. I don't think that the Swiss are particularly interested in blackmailing people. They have always had this attitude, and it certainly, it predates even the Second World War, where Switzerland was a so-called neutral country, which in fact wasn't so neutral. The Nazis parked all their loot there and stole all that art and put it in Switzerland. Switzerland was not aligned, that it wasn't part of the East or the West, that it was a place where you could quote-unquote do business. So it shouldn't surprise anyone that over the course of time, Switzerland, not only in its very secret banking aspects, but in its diplomacy as well, has tried to, you know, present itself as that kind of place. And the World Economic Forum, and again, I outline this in my book, is very, very, very heavily supported, not just by its members' big corporate accounts, but by the government of Switzerland. So they'd like to have people meet in Switzerland as an important place.
Talk to me about the Aspen Institute. What is that all about? What goes on there?
Well, the Aspen Institute is again another one of these elite institutions. There's certainly a lot more known about it. It's not nearly as secretive. It was formed in 1947 when a very wealthy American of German background, Walter Pepke, owned a small silver mining town which had gone more or less decrepit in the Rocky Mountains called Aspen, Colorado. Obviously, something quite different today. Had this idea with the president of the University of Chicago, Robert Hutchins, and a very famous philosopher, Mortimer Adler, to have a kind of commemoration of Goethe at a certain anniversary after the Second World War to try to bring the world together, and particularly Europe and Americans together, to talk about liberal democracy and the values that undergird it. And they had that very successful opening gate, as it were. Albert Schweitzer was the first speaker. He spoke in German, which was interesting, and it was translated by Thornton Wilder into English. And it basically then said, well, we might as well carry this on and have seminars, bring groups together, particularly corporate leaders, mingling them with generals and with foreign policy experts and with, all kinds of corporate people. And they could do some readings together and think together and have some policy discussions together. And that's more or less what the Aspen Institute has been for that, now 70 years. So it tries on a bipartisan basis. It's slightly more left-leaning than right-leaning, certainly, to have that and foster that kind of discussion. And they hold lots of seminars on lots of subjects. Some of them are very private. In other words, the Aspen Strategy Group is just the former heads of the Defense Department and the State Department and the CIA, and you don't get entry into that group unless you're one of them, all the way to executive seminars for corporations where people pay fairly large amounts of money to have people like me sit around with them and ask them hard questions about certain passages in Plato or reading Sophocles.
Would this be perhaps part and parcel of what Eisenhower was warning about? I mean, is this, do these individuals comprise what he called the military industrial complex?
It's a good time to revisit that Eisenhower phrase. I'm glad you bring it up. Obviously he was General Eisenhower. He was, commander of the Allied forces and president and very effective one during my childhood. And he was then critical in his last farewell speech about what he saw rising up in the form of a military industrial complex. And gave us I think, a rather adroit kind of definition of what that was and why we should be forewarned about it. So, yeah, in some way, these kinds of groups represent the apogee, the very top of the pyramid where those discussions take place. And we should be at least aware, if not wary of, that formation. And today we use a new term, I guess. The new phrase is the deep state.
Right,
Deep
right.
state.
I was going to ask you about that. To what extent do you think that term is being misused, overused, misunderstood?
Well, it's an emergent term. It certainly is used by some conspiracy theorists. It's more and more used, I think, in popular parlance and certainly by the media. What it means is really a little bit, I think, attached to what Eisenhower originally meant by the military-industrial complex. I use the term not frequently, but I use the term to describe the intelligence agencies, the Defense Department, the Department of Justice, and the FBI, not certainly your local government or the Department of Agriculture, and how they coordinate together sometimes against elected politicians and against the will of the people. So we need to be aware of these people that are entrenched and that try to put their points of view across, and in some ways abandon the democratic spirit.
They
It
used to call
certainly
that
would not, it would not have been something that the founding American fathers would have favored, where they wanted what was called a limited government and certainly very little bureaucracy. George Washington was offered a kingship three times during his presidency. This may not be well known. He turned it down every time. And in the end, I think the bravest thing that George Washington did, besides crossing the Delaware River, was in fact to go back to Monticello and to become just a regular, normal American again.
Right. This idea of the again the upper echelons of the CIA, the FBI, the State Department, the Department of Justice, acting against the will of the people, as you say. We used to call that sedition.
Well, it's a good old-fashioned term, and it's certainly there in the original document. So you need to be aware of what treason consists of, what sedition is, and whose will we're representing. It seems at times like there is a political class that is not just entrenched and incumbent, but doesn't want to be displaced. And I mean, we see that. I'm living in the UK presently. We see that even in the case of Brexit, where there are all kinds of establishment politicians who would like to see Brexit undone. Well, when you have a referendum and the people vote, 52 to 48, it wasn't overwhelming, but when they vote, you have to take their vote seriously. That is, the last time I checked, what democracy is.
Yeah, last time we checked. What time is it? But getting back to what is happening currently with the Mueller investigation and the emails flying back and forth between FBI agents wanting to derail the election and so forth, the will of the people. Where do you see this going?
Well, this concerns me so much that for the last number of months I've been writing and have just finished a book which will be out in April called The Plot to Destroy Trump, The Hunt for Red November. And it is a rather complicated tale, and it has many pieces, moving pieces, and many players. And we need to basically connect the dots here and to put it all together and to see the bigger plot, the conspiracy to delegitimize and depose the president that was elected. And I think that was hatched even before the election, before he was elected. And it involves some very interesting and spurious characters, including a former MI6 agent spy named Christopher Steele, who's very much in the news, and the disinformation that was put together in this Fusion GPS dossier. So my new book on that topic will do just that. And I must say, in writing it, I not only unearthed many new things, and some of them are really bombshells, but I've tried to connect these dots, which are all over the map. But
All right, maybe we can connect a few of those dots when we come back. Theodore Roosevelt Malick stays with it. Here's Bob Seger taking us into the break with an old Lou Reed tune called Bus Load of Faith, right here on Coast to Coast AM.